Chapter 1. Anne's Army. "I won't," cried Anne, "I won't sweep the floor. It is beneath my dignity."
"Someone must sweep it," replied Anne's younger sister, "Sullier, else we shall soon be waiting in dust. And you are the eldest, and the head of the family."
"I'm Queen of Wagaboo," said Anne, proudly. "But," she added with a sigh, "my kingdom is the smallest and the poorest in all the Land of Oz."
This was quite true. Away up in the mountains, in a far corner of the beautiful fairyland of Oz, lies a small valley which is named Wagaboo, and in this valley lived a few people who were usually happy and contented and never cared to wander over the mountain pass into the more settled parts of the land. They knew that all of Oz, including their own territory, was ruled by a beautiful princess named Ozma, who lived in the splendid Emerald City, yet the simple folk of Wagaboo never visited Ozma. They had a royal family of their own, not especially to rule over them, but just as a matter of pride. Ozma permitted the various parts of her country to have their kings and queens and emperors and the like, but all were ruled over by the lovely girl queen of the Emerald City. The king of Wagaboo used to be a man named Joel Jemkif Soforth, who for many years did all the drudgery of deciding disputes and telling his people when to plant cabbages and pickle onions. But the king's wife had a sharp tongue and small respect for the king, her husband, therefore one night King Joel crept over the pass into the Land of Oz and disappeared from Wagaboo for good and all. The queen waited a few years for him to return and then started in search of him, leaving her eldest daughter, and so forth, to act as queen. Now, Anne had not forgotten when her birthday came, for that meant a party and feasting and dancing, but she had quite forgotten how many years the birthdays marked. In a land where people live always, this is not considered a cause for regret, so we may justly say that Queen Anne of Wagaboo was old enough to make jelly and let it go at that. But she didn't make jelly, or do any more of the housework than she could help. She was an ambitious woman and constantly resented the fact that her kingdom was so tiny and her people so stupid and unenterprising. Often she wondered what had become of her father and mother, out beyond the pass, in the wonderful Land of Oz, and the fact that they did not return to Wagaboo led Anne to suspect that they had found a better place to live. So, when Sullier refused to sweep the floor of the living room in the palace, and Anne would not sweep it, either, she said to her sister, "I'm going away. This absurd kingdom of Wagaboo tires me."
"Go, if you want to," answered Sullier, "but you are very foolish to leave this place."
"Why?" asked Anne.
"Because in the Land of Oz, which is Ozma's country, you will be a nobody, while here you are a queen."
"Oh, yes. Queen over 18 men, 27 women and 44 children," returned Anne bitterly.
"Well, there are certainly more people than that in the great Land of Oz," laughed Sullier. "Why don't you raise an army and conquer them, and be Queen of Oz?" she asked, trying to taunt Anne and so to anger her. Then she made a face at her sister and went into the backyard to swing in the hammock. Her jeering words, however, had given Queen Anne an idea. She reflected that Oz was reported to be a peaceful country and Ozma a mere girl who ruled with gentleness to all and was obeyed because her people loved her. Even in Wagaboo the story was told that Ozma's sole army consisted of 27 fine officers, who wore beautiful uniforms but carried no weapons, because there was no one to fight. Once there had been a private soldier, besides the officers, but Ozma had made him a captain general and taken away his gun for fear it might accidentally hurt someone. The more Anne thought about the matter, the more she was convinced it would be easy to conquer the Land of Oz and set herself up as ruler in Ozma's place, if she but had an army to do it with. Afterwards she could go out into the world and conquer other lands, and then perhaps she could find a way to the moon, and conquer that. She had a warlike spirit that preferred trouble to idleness. It all depended on an army, and decided. She carefully counted in her mind all the men of her kingdom. Yes, there were exactly 18 of them, all told. That would not make a very big army, but by surprising Ozma's unarmed officers her men might easily subdue them. Gentle people are always afraid of those that bluster, and told herself. "I don't wish to shed any blood, for that would shock my nerves and I might faint, but if we threaten and flash our weapons I am sure the people of Oz will fall upon their knees before me and surrender." This argument, which she repeated to herself more than once, finally determined the Queen of Wagaboo to undertake the audacious venture. "Whatever happens," she reflected, "can make me no more unhappy than my staying shut up in this miserable valley and sweeping floors and quarreling with Sister Sullier, so I will venture all, and win what I may." That very day she started out to organize her army. The first man she came to was Joe Apple, so called because he had an apple orchard.
"Joe," said Anne, "I am going to conquer the world, and I want you to join my army."
"Don't ask me to do such a fool thing,
"For I must politely refuse your majesty," said Joe Apple. "I have no intention of asking you. I shall command you, as Queen of Ouagadougou, to join," said Anne.
"In that case, I suppose I must obey," the man remarked, in a sad voice. "But I pray you to consider that I am a very important citizen, and for that reason am entitled to an office of high rank."
"You shall be a general," promised Anne.
"With gold epaulettes and a sword?" he asked.
"Of course," said the queen.
Then she went to the next man, whose name was Joe Bunn, as he owned an orchard where graham buns and wheat buns, in great variety, both hot and cold, grew on the trees.
"Joe," said Anne, "I am going to conquer the world, and I command you to join my army."
"Impossible," he exclaimed. "The bun crop has to be picked."
"Let your wife and children do the picking," said Anne.
"But I'm a man of great importance, your majesty," he protested.
"For that reason you shall be one of my generals, and wear a cocked hat with gold braid, and curl your mustaches and clank a long sword," she promised.
So he consented, although sorely against his will, and the queen walked on to the next cottage. Here lived Joe Cone, so called because the trees in his orchard bore crops of excellent ice cream cones.
"Joe," said Anne, "I am going to conquer the world, and you must join my army."
"Excuse me, please," said Joe Cone. "I am a bad fighter. My good wife conquered me years ago, for she can fight better than I take her, your majesty, instead of me, and I'll bless you for the favor."
"This must be an army of men, fierce, ferocious warriors," declared Anne, looking sternly upon the mild little man.
"And you will leave my wife here in Ouagadougou?" he asked.
"Yes, and make you a general."
"I'll go," said Joe Cone, and Anne went on to the cottage of Joe Clock, who had an orchard of clock trees. This man at first insisted that he would not join the army, but Queen Anne's promise to make him a general finally won his consent.
"How many generals are there in your army?" he asked.
4, so far," replied Anne.
"And how big will the army be?" was his next question.
"I intend to make every one of the 18 men in Ouagadougou join it," she said.
"Then 4 generals are enough," announced Joe Clock. "I advise you to make the rest of them colonels."
Anne tried to follow his advice. The next 4 men she visited, who were Joe Plum, Joe Egg, Joe Banjo, and Joe Cheese, named after the trees in their orchard, she made colonels of her army, but the 5th one, Joe Nails, said colonels and generals were getting to be altogether too common in the army of Ouagadougou and he preferred to be a major. So Joe Nails, Joe Cake, Joe Ham and Joe Stockings were all 4 made majors, while the next 4 Joe Sandwich, Joe Padlocks, Joe Sunday and Joe Buttons were appointed captains of the army. But now Queen Anne was in a quandary. There remained but 2 other men in all Ouagadougou, and if she made these 2 lieutenants, while there were 4 captains, 4 majors, 4 colonels and 4 generals, there was likely to be jealousy in her army, and perhaps mutiny and desertions. One of these men, however, was Joe Candy, and he would not go at all. No promises could tempt him, nor could threats move him. He said he must remain at home to harvest his crop of Jackson balls, lemon drops, bonbons and chocolate creams. Also he had large fields of cracker jack and buttered popcorn to be mowed and threshed, and he was determined not to disappoint the children of Ouagadougou by going away to conquer the world and so let the candy crop spoil. Finding Joe Candy so obstinate, Queen Anne let him have his own way and continued her journey to the house of the 18th and last man in Ouagadougou, who was a young fellow named Joe Files. This Files had 12 trees which bore steel files of various sorts, but also he had 9 book trees, on which grew a choice selection of storybooks. In case you have never seen books growing upon trees, I will explain that those in Joe Files' orchard were enclosed in broad green husks which, when fully ripe, turned to a deep red color. Then the books were picked and husked and were ready to read. If they were picked too soon, the stories were found to be confused and uninteresting and the spelling bad. However, if allowed to ripen perfectly, the stories were fine reading and the spelling and grammar excellent. Files freely gave his books to all who wanted them, but the people of Ouagadougou cared little for books and so he had to read most of them himself, before they spoiled. For, as you probably know, as soon as the books were read the words disappeared and the leaves withered and faded, which is the worst fault of all books which grow upon trees. When Queen Anne spoke to this young man Files, who was both intelligent and ambitious, he said he thought it would be great fun to conquer the world. But he called her attention to the fact that he was far superior to the other men of her army. Therefore, he would not be one of her generals or colonels or majors or captains, but claimed the honor of being sole private. And did not like this idea at all.
I hate to have a private soldier in my army, she said, they're so common. I am told that Princess Ozma once had a private soldier, but she made him her captain general, which is good evidence that the private was unnecessary.
Ozma's army doesn't fight, returned Files, but your army must fight like fury in order to conquer the world. I have read in my books that it is always the private soldiers who do the fighting, for no officer is ever brave enough to face the foe. Also, it stands to reason that your officers must have someone to command and to issue their orders to, therefore I'll be the one. I long to slash and slay the enemy and become a hero. Then, when we return to Ouagadougou, I'll take all the marbles away from the children and melt them up and make a marble statue of myself for all to look upon and admire. Anne was much pleased with Private Files. He seemed indeed to be such a warrior as she needed in her enterprise, and her hopes of success took a sudden bound when Files told her he knew where a gun tree grew and would go there at once and pick the ripest and biggest musk at the tree bore. Chapter 2. Out of Ouagadougou. 3 days later, the Grand Army of Ouagadougou assembled in the square in front of the royal palace. The 16 officers were attired in gorgeous uniforms and carried sharp, glittering swords. The private had picked his gun and, although it was not a very big weapon, Files tried to look fierce and succeeded so well that all his commanding officers were secretly afraid of him. The women were there, protesting that Queen Anne so forth had no right to take their husbands and fathers from them, but Anne commanded them to keep silent, and that was the hardest order to obey they had ever received. The Queen appeared before her army dressed in an imposing uniform of green, covered with gold braid. She wore a green soldier cap with a purple plume in it and looked so royal and dignified that everyone in Ouagadougou except the army was glad she was going. The army was sorry she was not going alone. "Form ranks!" she cried in her shrill voice. Salier leaned out of the palace window and laughed. "I believe your army can run better than it can fight," she observed. "Of course," replied General Bun, proudly. "We're not looking for trouble, you know, but for plunder. The more plunder and the less fighting we get, the better we shall like our work." "For my part," said Files, "I prefer war and carnage to anything. The only way to become a hero is to conquer, and the storybooks all say that the easiest way to conquer is to fight."
"That's the idea, my brave man," agreed Anne. "To fight is to conquer, and to conquer is to secure plunder, and to secure plunder is to become a hero. With such noble determination to back me, the world is mine. Goodbye, Salier. When we return we shall be rich and famous. Come, generals, let us march." At this the generals straightened up and threw out their chests. Then they swung their glittering swords in rapid circles and cried to the colonels, "Forward march!" Then the colonels shouted to the majors, "Forward march!" And the majors yelled to the captains, "Forward march!" And the captain screamed to the private, "Forward march!" So Files shouldered his gun and began to march, and all the officers followed after him. Queen Anne came last of all, rejoicing in her noble army and wondering why she had not decided long ago to conquer the world. In this order the procession marched out of Ouagadougou and took the narrow mountain pass which led into the lovely fairyland of Oz. Chapter 3. Magic mystifies the marchers. Princess Ozma was all unaware that the army of Ouagadougou, led by their ambitious queen, was determined to conquer her kingdom. The beautiful girl ruler of Oz was busy with the welfare of her subjects and had no time to think of Anne Soforth and her disloyal plans. But there was one who constantly guarded the peace and happiness of the land of Oz, and this was the official sorceress of the kingdom, Glinda the Good. In her magnificent castle, which stands far north of the Emerald City where Ozma holds her court, Glinda owns a wonderful magic record book, in which is printed every event that takes place anywhere, just as soon as it happens. The smallest things and the biggest things are all recorded in this book. If a child stamps its foot in anger, Glinda reads about it. If a city burns down, Glinda finds the fact noted in her book. The sorceress always reads her record book every day, and so it was she knew that Anne Soforth, Queen of Ouagadougou, had foolishly assembled an army of 16 officers and one private soldier, with which she intended to invade and conquer the land of Oz. There was no danger but that Ozma, supported by the magic arts of Glinda the Good and the powerful Wizard of Oz, both her firm friends, could easily defeat a far more imposing army than Anne's. But it would be a shame to have the peace of Oz interrupted by any sort of quarreling or fighting. So Glinda did not even mention the matter to Ozma, or to anyone else. She merely went into a great chamber of her castle, known as the Magic Room, where she performed a magical ceremony which caused the mountain pass that led from Ouagadougou to make several turns and twists. The result was that when Anne and her army came to the end of the pass, they were not in the land of Oz at all, but in an adjoining territory that was quite distinct from Ozma's domain and separated from Oz by an invisible barrier.
As the Ouagadougou people emerged into this country, the pass they had traversed disappeared behind them and it was not likely they would ever find their way back into the valley of Ouagadougou. They were greatly puzzled, indeed, by their surroundings and did not know which way to go. None of them had ever visited Oz, so it took them some time to discover they were not in Oz at all, but in an unknown country. "Never mind," said Anne, trying to conceal her disappointment, "we have started out to conquer the world, and here is part of it. In time, as we pursue our victorious journey, we will doubtless come to Oz, but, until we get there, we may as well conquer whatever land we find ourselves in." "Have we conquered this place, Your Majesty?" anxiously inquired Major Cake. "Most certainly," said Anne. "We have met no people, as yet, but when we do, we will inform them that they are our slaves. And afterward we will plunder them of all their possessions," added General Apple. "They may not possess anything," objected Private Files, "but I hope they will fight us, just the same. A peaceful conquest wouldn't be any fun at all."
"Don't worry," said the Queen. _we_ can fight, whether our foes do or not, and perhaps we would find it more comfortable to have the enemy surrender promptly." It was a barren country and not very pleasant to travel in. Moreover, there was little for them to eat, and as the officers became hungry they became fretful. Many would have deserted had they been able to find their way home, but as the Ouagadougou people were now hopelessly lost in a strange country they considered it more safe to keep together than to separate. Queen Anne's temper, never very agreeable, became sharp and irritable as she and her army tramped over the rocky roads without encountering either people or plunder. She scolded her officers until they became surly, and a few of them were disloyal enough to ask her to hold her tongue. Others began to reproach her for leading them into difficulties, and in the space of 3 unhappy days every man was mourning for his orchard in the pretty valley of Ouagadougou. Files, however, proved a different sort. The more difficulties he encountered the more cheerful he became, and the sighs of the officers were answered by the merry whistle of the private. His pleasant disposition did much to encourage Queen Anne, and before long she consulted the private soldier more often than she did his superiors. It was on the 3rd day of their pilgrimage that they encountered their first adventure. Toward evening the sky was suddenly darkened and Major Nails exclaimed, "A fog is coming toward us." "I do not think it is a fog," replied Files, looking with interest at the approaching cloud. "It seems to me more like the breath of a rock."
"What is a rock?" asked Anne, looking about fearfully.
"A terrible beast with a horrible appetite," answered the soldier, growing a little paler than usual. "I have never seen a rock, to be sure, but I've read of them in the storybooks that grew in my orchard, and if this is indeed one of those fearful monsters, we are not likely to conquer the world." Hearing this, the officers became quite worried and gathered closer about their soldier.
"What is the thing like?" asked one.
"The only picture of a rock that I ever saw in a book was rather blurred," said Files, "because the book was not quite ripe when it was picked. But the creature can fly in the air and run like a deer and swim like a fish. Inside its body is a glowing furnace of fire, and the rock breathes in air and breathes out smoke, which darkens the sky for miles around, wherever it goes. It is bigger than 100 men and feeds on any living thing." The officers now began to groan and to tremble, but Files tried to cheer them, saying, "It may not be a rock, after all, that we see approaching us, and you must not forget that we people of Ouagadougou, which is part of the fairyland of Oz, cannot be killed."
"Nevertheless," said Captain Buttons, "if the rock catches us, and chews us up into small pieces, and swallows us, what will happen then?"
"Then each small piece will still be alive," declared Files.
"I cannot see how that would help us," wailed Colonel Banjo. "A hamburger steak is a hamburger steak, whether it is alive or not."
"I tell you, this may not be a rock," persisted Files. "We will know, when the cloud gets nearer, whether it is the breath of a rock or not. If it has no smell at all, it is probably a fog, but if it has an odor of salt and pepper, it is a rock and we must prepare for a desperate fight." They all eyed the dark cloud fearfully. Before long it reached the frightened group and began to envelop them. Every nose sniffed the cloud and everyone detected in it the odor of salt and pepper.
"The rock!" shouted Private Files, and with a howl of despair the 16 officers fell to the ground, writhing and moaning in anguish. Queen Anne sat down upon a rock and faced the cloud more bravely, although her heart was beating fast. As for Files, he calmly loaded his gun and stood ready to fight the foe, as a soldier should. They were now in absolute darkness, for the cloud which covered the sky and the setting sun was black as ink. Then through the gloom appeared 2 round, glowing balls of red, and Files at once decided these must be the monster's eyes. He raised his gun, took aim and fired. There were several bullets in the gun,
all gathered from an excellent bullet tree in Ouagadougou, and they were big and hard. They flew toward the monster and struck it, and with a wild, weird cry the rock came fluttering down and its huge body fell plump upon the forms of the 16 officers, who thereupon screamed louder than before.
"Badness me!" moaned the rock. "See what you've done with that dangerous gun of yours."
"I can't see," replied Files, "for the cloud formed by your breath darkens my sight."
"Don't tell me it was an accident," continued the rock, reproachfully, as it still flapped its wings in a helpless manner.
"Don't claim you didn't know the gun was loaded, I beg of you."
"I don't intend to," replied Files. "Did the bullets hurt you very badly?"
"One has broken my jaw, so that I can't open my mouth. You will notice that my voice sounds rather harsh and husky, because I have to talk with my teeth set close together. Another bullet broke my left wing, so that I can't fly, and still another broke my right leg, so that I can't walk. It was the most careless shot I ever heard of."
"Can't you manage to lift your body off from my commanding officers?" inquired Files. "From their cries I'm afraid your great weight is crushing them."
"I hope it is," growled the rock. "I want to crush them, if possible, for I have a bad disposition. If only I could open my mouth, I'd eat all of you, although my appetite is poorly this warm weather."
With this the rock began to roll its immense body sidewise, so as to crush the officers more easily, but in doing this it rolled completely off from them and the entire 16 scrambled to their feet and made off as fast as they could run. Private Files could not see them go, but he knew from the sound of their voices that they had escaped, so he ceased to worry about them.
"Pardon me if I now bid you goodbye," he said to the rock. "The parting is caused by our desire to continue our journey. If you die, do not blame me, for I was obliged to shoot you as a matter of self-protection."
"I shall not die," answered the monster, "for I bear a charmed life. But I beg you not to leave me."
"Why not?" asked Files.
"Because my broken jaw will heal in about an hour, and then I shall be able to eat you. My wing will heal in a day and my leg will heal in a week, when I shall be as well as ever. Having shot me, and so caused me all this annoyance, it is only fair and just that you remain here and allow me to eat you as soon as I can open my jaws."
"I beg to differ with you," returned the soldier firmly. "I have made an engagement with Queen Anne of Ouagadougou to help her conquer the world, and I cannot break my word for the sake of being eaten by a rock."
"Oh, that's different," said the monster. "If you've an engagement, don't let me detain you."
So Files felt around in the dark and grasped the hand of the trembling queen, whom he led away from the flapping, sighing rock. They stumbled over the stones for a way but presently began to see dimly the path ahead of them, as they got farther and farther away from the dreadful spot where the wounded monster lay. By and by they reached a little hill and could see the last rays of the sun flooding a pretty valley beyond, for now they had passed beyond the cloudy breath of the rock. Here were huddled the 16 officers, still frightened and panting from their run. They had halted only because it was impossible for them to run any farther. Queen Anne gave them a severe scolding for their cowardice, at the same time praising Files for his courage.
"We are wiser than he, however," muttered General Clock, "for by running away we are now able to assist Your Majesty in conquering the world, whereas, had Files been eaten by the rock, he would have deserted your army." After a brief rest they descended into the valley, and as soon as they were out of sight of the rock the spirits of the entire party rose quickly. Just at dusk they came to a brook, on the banks of which Queen Anne commanded them to make camp for the night. Each officer carried in his pocket a tiny white tent. This, when placed upon the ground, quickly grew in size until it was large enough to permit the owner to enter it and sleep within its canvas walls. Files was obliged to carry a knapsack, in which was not only his own tent but an elaborate pavilion for Queen Anne, besides a bed and chair and a magic table. This table, when set upon the ground in Anne's pavilion, became of large size, and in a drawer of the table was contained the queen's supply of extra clothing, her manicure and toilet articles and other necessary things. The royal bed was the only one in the camp, the officers and privates sleeping in hammocks attached to their tent poles. There was also in the knapsack a flag bearing the royal emblem of Ouagadougou, and this flag Files flew upon its staff every night, to show that the country they were in had been conquered by the Queen of Ouagadougou. So far, no one but themselves had seen the flag, but Anne was pleased to see it flutter in the breeze and considered herself already a famous conqueror.
Chapter 4. Betsy Braves the Billows. The waves dashed and the lightning flashed and the thunder rolled and the ship struck a rock. Betsy Bobbin was running across the deck and the shock sent her flying through the air until she fell with a splash into the dark blue water. The same shock caught Hank, a thin little, sad-faced mule, and tumbled him also into the sea, far from the ship's side. When Betsy came up,
Gasping for breath because the wet plunge had surprised her, she reached out in the dark and grabbed a bunch of hair. At first she thought it was the end of a rope, but presently she heard a dismal hee-haw, and knew she was holding fast to the end of Hank's tail. Suddenly the sea was lighted up by a vivid glare. The ship, now in the far distance, caught fire, blew up and sank beneath the waves. Betsy shuddered at the sight, but just then her eye caught a mass of wreckage floating near her and she let go the mule's tail and seized the rude raft, pulling herself up so that she rode upon it in safety. Hank also saw the raft and swam to it, but he was so clumsy he never would have been able to climb upon it had not Betsy helped him to get aboard. They had to crowd close together, for their support was only a hatch cover torn from the ship's deck, but it floated them fairly well and both the girl and the mule knew it would keep them from drowning. The storm was not over, by any means, when the ship went down. Blinding bolts of lightning shot from cloud to cloud and the clamor of deep thunderclaps echoed far over the sea. The waves tossed the little raft here and there as a child tosses a rubber ball and Betsy had a solemn feeling that for hundreds of watery miles in every direction there was no living thing besides herself and the small donkey. Perhaps Hank had the same thought, for he gently rubbed his nose against the frightened girl and said hee-haw, in his softest voice, as if to comfort her. "You'll protect me, Hank dear, won't you?" she cried helplessly. And the mule said hee-haw. Again, in tones that meant a promise. On board the ship, during the days that preceded the wreck, when the sea was calm, Betsy and Hank had become good friends, so, while the girl might have preferred a more powerful protector in this dreadful emergency, she felt that the mule would do all in a mule's power to guard her safety. All night they floated, and when the storm had worn itself out and passed away with a few distant growls, and the waves had grown smaller and easier to ride, Betsy stretched herself out on the wet raft and fell asleep. Hank did not sleep a wink. Perhaps he felt it his duty to guard Betsy. Anyhow, he crouched on the raft beside the tired sleeping girl and watched patiently until the first light of dawn swept over the sea. The light wakened Betsy Bobbin. She sat up, rubbed her eyes and stared across the water. "Oh, Hank, there's land ahead!" she exclaimed. "Hee-haw!" answered Hank in his plaintive voice. The raft was floating swiftly toward a very beautiful country and as they drew near Betsy could see banks of lovely flowers showing brightly between leafy trees. But no people were to be seen at all. Chapter 5. The roses repulse the refugees. Gently the raft grated on the sandy beach. Then Betsy easily waded ashore, the mule following closely behind her. The sun was now shining and the air was warm and laden with the fragrance of roses. "I'd like some breakfast, Hank," remarked the girl, feeling more cheerful now that she was on dry land, "but we can't eat the flowers, although they do smell mighty good." "Hee-haw!" replied Hank and trotted up a little pathway to the top of the bank. Betsy followed and from the eminence looked around her. A little way off stood a splendid big greenhouse, its thousands of crystal panes glittering in the sunlight. "There ought to be people somewhere around," observed Betsy thoughtfully, "gardeners, or somebody. Let's go and see, Hank. I'm getting hungrier every minute." So they walked toward the great greenhouse and came to its entrance without meeting with anyone at all. A door stood ajar, so Hank went in first, thinking if there was any danger he could back out and warn his companion. But Betsy was close at his heels and the moment she entered was lost in amazement at the wonderful sight she saw. The greenhouse was filled with magnificent rose bushes, all growing in big pots. On the central stem of each bush bloomed a splendid rose, gorgeously colored and deliciously fragrant, and in the center of each rose was the face of a lovely girl. As Betsy and Hank entered, the heads of the roses were drooping and their eyelids were closed in slumber, but the mule was so amazed that he uttered a loud hee-haw. And at the sound of his harsh voice the rose leaves fluttered, the roses raised their heads and 100 startled eyes were instantly fixed upon the intruders. I beg your pardon," stammered Betsy, blushing and confused. "Oh," cried the roses, in a sort of sighing chorus, and one of them added, "What a horrid noise!" "Why, that was only Hank," said Betsy, and as if to prove the truth of her words the mule uttered another loud hee-haw. At this all the roses turned on their stems as far as they were able and trembled as if someone were shaking their bushes. A dainty moss rose gasped, "Dear me! How dreadfully dreadful!" "It isn't dreadful at all," said Betsy, somewhat indignant. "When you get used to Hank's voice it will put you to sleep." The roses now looked at the mule less fearfully and one of them asked, "Is that savage beast named Hank?" "Yes, Hank's my comrade, faithful and true," answered the girl, twining her arms around the little mule's neck and hugging him tight. "Aren't you, Hank?" Hank could only say in reply, "Hee-haw!" And at his bray the roses shivered again.
Please go away, begged one.
Can't you see you're frightening us out of a week's growth?
Go away, echoed Betsy. Why, we've no place to go. We've just been wrecked.
Wrecked? Asked the roses in a surprised chorus.
Yes, we were on a big ship and the storm came and wrecked it, explained the girl. But Hank and I caught hold of a raft and floated ashore to this place, and we're tired and hungry. What country __ this, please?
This is the Rose Kingdom, replied the moss rose, haughtily, and it is devoted to the culture of the rarest and fairest roses grown.
I believe it, said Betsy, admiring the pretty blossoms.
But only roses are allowed here, continued a delicate tea rose, bending her brows in a frown, therefore you must go away before the royal gardener finds you and casts you back into the sea.
Oh! Is there a royal gardener, then? Inquired Betsy.
To be sure.
And is he a rose, also?
Of course not, he's a man, a wonderful man, was the reply.
Well, I'm not afraid of a man, declared the girl, much relieved, and even as she spoke the royal gardener popped into the greenhouse a spading fork in one hand and a watering pot in the other. He was a funny little man, dressed in a rose-colored costume, with ribbons at his knees and elbows, and a bunch of ribbons in his hair. His eyes were small and twinkling, his nose sharp and his face puckered and deeply lined.
Oh ho! He exclaimed, astonished to find strangers in his greenhouse, and when Hank gave a loud bray the gardener threw the watering pot over the mule's head and danced around with his fork, in such agitation that presently he fell over the handle of the implement and sprawled at full length upon the ground.
Betsy laughed and pulled the watering pot off from Hank's head. The little mule was angry at the treatment he had received and backed toward the gardener threateningly.
Look out for his heels! Called Betsy warningly and the gardener scrambled to his feet and hastily hid behind the roses.
You are breaking the law! He shouted, sticking out his head to glare at the girl and the mule.
What law? Asked Betsy.
The law of the Rose Kingdom. No strangers are allowed in these domains.
Not when they're shipwrecked? She inquired.
The law doesn't accept shipwrecks, replied the royal gardener, and he was about to say more when suddenly there was a crash of glass and a man came tumbling through the roof of the greenhouse and fell plump to the ground.
Chapter 6. Shaggy Seeks His Stray Brother. This sudden arrival was a queer-looking man, dressed all in garments so shaggy that Betsy at first thought he must be some animal. But the stranger ended his fall in a sitting position and then the girl saw it was really a man. He held an apple in his hand, which he had evidently been eating when he fell. And so little was he jarred or flustered by the accident that he continued to munch this apple as he calmly looked around him.
Good gracious! Exclaimed Betsy, approaching him. Who __ you, and where did you come from?
Me? Oh, I'm Shaggy Man, said he, taking another bite of the apple. Just dropped in for a short call. Excuse my seeming haste.
Why, I suppose you couldn't help the haste, said Betsy.
No. I climbed an apple tree, outside. Branch gave way and here I am.
As he spoke the shaggy man finished his apple, gave the core to Hank who ate it greedily and then stood up to bow politely to Betsy and the roses. The royal gardener had been frightened nearly into fits by the crash of glass and the fall of the shaggy stranger into the bower of roses, but now he peeped out from behind a bush and cried in his squeaky voice.
You're breaking the law. You're breaking the law.
Shaggy stared at him solemnly.
Is the glass the law in this country? He asked.
Breaking the glass is breaking the law, squeaked the gardener, angrily. Also, to intrude in any part of the Rose Kingdom is breaking the law.
How do you know? Asked Shaggy.
Why, it's printed in a book, said the gardener, coming forward and taking a small book from his pocket. Page 13. Here it is, if any stranger enters the Rose Kingdom he shall at once be condemned by the ruler and put to death. So you see, strangers, he continued triumphantly. It's death for you all and your time has come. But just here Hank interposed. He had been stealthily backing toward the royal gardener, whom he disliked, and now the mule's heels shot out and struck the little man in the middle. He doubled up like the letter U and flew out of the door so swiftly never touching the ground that he was gone before Betsy had time to wink. But the mule's attack frightened the girl.
Come, she whispered, approaching the shaggy man and taking his hand, let's go somewhere else. They'll surely kill us if we stay here.
Don't worry, my dear, replied Shaggy, patting the child's head. I'm not afraid of anything, so long as I have the love magnet.
The love magnet?
Why, what is that? Asked Betsy.
It's a charming little enchantment that wins the heart of everyone who looks upon it, was the reply. The love magnet used to hang over the gateway to the Emerald City, in the Land of Oz,
But when I started on this journey, our beloved ruler, Ozma of Oz, allowed me to take it with me.
Oh! Cried Betsy, staring hard at him, are you really from the wonderful land of Oz?
Yes. Ever been there, my dear?
No, but I've heard about it. And do you know Princess Ozma?
Very well indeed.
And in Princess Dorothy?
Dorothy's an old chum of mine, declared Shaggy.
Dear me! Exclaimed Betsy. And why did you ever leave such a beautiful land as Oz?
On an errand, said Shaggy, looking sad and solemn. I'm trying to find my dear little brother.
Oh! Is he lost? Questioned Betsy, feeling very sorry for the poor man.
Been lost these 10 years, replied Shaggy, taking out a handkerchief and wiping a tear from his eye. I didn't know it until lately, when I saw it recorded in the magic record book of the sorceress Glinda, in the land of Oz. So now I'm trying to find him.
Where was he lost? Asked the girl sympathetically.
Back in Colorado, where I used to live before I went to Oz. Brother was a miner, and dug gold out of a mine. One day he went into his mine and never came out. They searched for him, but he was not there. Disappeared entirely, Shaggy ended miserably.
For goodness sake! What do you suppose became of him? She asked.
There is only one explanation, replied Shaggy, taking another apple from his pocket and eating it to relieve his misery. The Gnome King probably got him.
The Gnome King? Who is he?
Why, he's sometimes called the Metal Monarch, and his name is Rugado. Lives in some underground cavern. Claims to own all the metals hidden in the earth. Don't ask me why.
Why?
'Cause I don't know. But this Rugado gets wild with anger if anyone digs gold out of the earth, and my private opinion